Welcome to this podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California, a nonprofit, nonpartisan forum open to the public. I'm Gloria Duffy, President and CEO of the club. To learn more about events or membership, join us online at commonwealthclub.org.
Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. This is the place where you are in the know. You can find us on the internet at commonwealthclub.org. I'm Dr. Charles Geschke, member of the Commonwealth Club Board of Governors, and I'm serving as your chair for this evening's program. Tonight's program is part of a series of programs underwritten by the Geschke family, which examines the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century. The Commonwealth Club series on the U.S. Constitution examines the balance between safety, security, and public order on the one hand, and the protection of civil liberties and the integrity of the U.S. Constitution on the other hand. Tonight's program is going to focus on the issue of civil liberties and whether or not there has been an erosion of American democracy since 9/11. Before introducing our speaker, I would like to mention that tonight's question and answer portion of the program will be moderated by Professor Jeffrey Brand, the Dean and Chairman of the Center for Law and Global Justice at the University of San Francisco School of Law. As a teacher, it's quite amazing that Dean Brand has received the USF School of Law Distinguished Professor Award 4 times during his career. His scholarly and professional work have focused on human rights, global justice, constitutional law, and various civil procedure and evidence issues. Dean Brand received his JD from the UC Berkeley School of Law. And now it's my pleasure to introduce our very special guest, Susan Herman, who is president of the American Civil Liberties Union. Susan was elected president of the union in October of 2008, after having served on the ACLU National Board of Directors for 20 years, and as a member of the Executive Committee for 16 years, and as General Counsel for 10 years. Herman holds a chair as the Centennial Professor of Law at Brooklyn Law School, where she currently teaches courses in constitutional law and criminals procedure, and seminars on law and literature and terrorism and civil liberties. She writes extensively on constitutional and criminal procedures topics for scholarly and other publications, ranging from law reviews and books to periodicals and online publications. Recent publications include 3 books, one Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of the American Democracy, which is her latest book, as well as Terrorism, Government, and Law, National Authority and Local Autonomy in the War on Terror, and the 3rd book, The Right to a Speedy and Public Trial, which is part of a series on the U.S. Constitution. She's also written several law review articles, including ones on the USA Patriot Act and the 4th Amendment. Herman has discussed constitutional law issues also on radio, TV, and in print media, including at Newsday and the New York Times. In addition, she's been a frequent speaker at academic conferences and continuing legal education events organized by the Federal Judicial Center and the American Bar Association. She's also participated in Supreme Court litigation, writing and collaborating on amicus curiae briefs for the ACLU on a range of constitutional and criminal procedures, and conducting Supreme Court moot courts. She received her BA in philosophy from Barnard College and a JD from New York University of Law, where she was a note and comment editor on the NYU Law Review. Before entering teaching, Professor Herman was a pro se law clerk for the United States Court of Appeals for the Second Circuit and a staff attorney and then associate director of Prisoners Legal Services of New York. I ask you all to please join me in giving a warm welcome for Susan Herman to the Commonwealth Club.
Thank you so much, Chuck, and thanks to all of you at the Commonwealth Club for the invitation to be with you here tonight. We were just talking before I came out here, and Chuck was saying that one of the things that's so important to him about this series is the prospect of being able to educate people in the country more about the Constitution. And I see, although my book is sort of tends to be described as for the 10th anniversary of 9/11 or the 10th anniversary of the Patriot Act, I think what I've really done here is to write a book that's about the Constitution and how the Constitution works, how it's threatened, and how in some ways it really is very resilient. So even though this is a very national story and involves things that happen at the federal level and happen all over the country, because we're here in San Francisco, I wanted to begin the story in San Francisco with somebody who is in fact in the room tonight, because this to me, it's sort of an example, the local example of what has happened multiplied exponentially all over the country in many different areas. So let me introduce you to Jan Adams, who's sitting over here. Jan and Rebecca Gordon in 2002 had some problems with the way the government was conducting itself in the war on terror, and they were publishing a newspaper called The War Times, in which they were somewhat critical of some things that the Bush administration was doing. Well, in 2002, they went to fly from SFO to Chicago and found when they got to the airport, they were told that their names were on a no-fly list. Well, they were very interested in this, neither of them being a terrorist. Does Jan look like a terrorist to you, I ask you? So they were very mystified as to how they had gotten on the list and also really somewhat skeptical and really wondered whether the reason why they had ended up on this watch list was that they had been critical of things that the government was doing. So Jan and Rebecca became clients of the American Civil Liberties Union, which brought, on their behalf as well as others, a Freedom of Information Act lawsuit asking the government, well, how do people end up on the no-fly list? Do you have a policy that would permit you to put people on the no-fly list just because they take positions that are anti-war positions or dissident positions? They asked a lot of questions. Well, I have to tell you, you can ask Jan maybe about this afterwards, but I don't think that they ever got a good answer to the question about why their names were on the list. But what they did find out, ACLU got a lot of documents in response to this lawsuit. And the documents were really pretty chilling, even though they didn't provide an answer, because it was perfectly clear that the way that the government was putting people's names on the no-fly list was totally dysfunctional. They were making all these decisions behind closed doors, often on the basis of very unreliable evidence. They didn't really keep track of, how they were doing or how many people were stopped. They declined to say whether or not they actually did target people based on their political beliefs or whatever else. So one thing that was very clear was, it was pretty easy to get on the no-fly list, perhaps for no good reason at all, but it was very difficult to get off. So that was 2002, where, the ACLU started, in some ways, litigating a lot of what was going on. The government was really keeping secret a lot of what it was doing, its detention policies, its interrogation policies, even its surveillance policies. And therefore, the Freedom of Information Act became very important to the ACLU as a way to begin at least just finding out some of what the government was doing. Well, over the years since 2002, Congress did show some concern about the no-fly lists, and several times Congress said to the agencies involved, could you please at least figure out some way that innocent people can get off the no-fly list? If it turns out you've made a mistake, could you, figure out some way to do something about that? So there's been some activity over the years in the Homeland Security Department, in the Transportation Security Administration, and in various government agencies. And they have all these programs. One is called Secure Flight. Another is called the DHS TRIP form, the Department of Homeland Security Traveler Redress. I forget what the I is for, program, information, something. And the agencies say, oh, yes, well, we have this all under control. We do these no-fly lists, but we have to do that because we have to protect people against possible terrorists on the plane. Is it possible that mistakes would be made? Sure, but if mistakes are made, people can just apply for their traveler redress control number, and they submit a form. I have a nice picture of the first page of the form in my book. You submit this form, and then they'll look into whether or not, in fact, you were improperly put on the no-fly list. So have things gotten better? Well, let me tell you, the ACLU, including the ACLU of Northern California, has a current lawsuit pending on behalf of, this is going to sound familiar, some ACLU clients who are on the no-fly list, and they don't know why they're there. But let me give you some examples. Jan and Rebecca, I'm sure, were very highly indignant. Did you ever get to Chicago? They got to Chicago. Okay, so, they were delayed. They did get to Chicago. So you might think, okay, not so bad as it might have been. The ACLU has clients now as to whom the no-fly list has been no joke. In our current lawsuit, there are a number of American citizens who are living abroad who are unable to come back to this country because their names are on the no-fly list for reasons they do not understand. At least one of those people, I believe it's Halima Sat, is in fact a resident of California. And she is a German citizen. She's a legal resident in this country. She's married to a United States citizen, and she's a Muslim. And she was not able to fly from Long Beach to Oakland. You tried to get on a plane, had a problem there. She's had to cancel plans to participate in educational programs and to go to her family reunion in Germany because she's on the no-fly list for reasons she doesn't really understand. And she's not a political dissident. The only thing she can imagine, and that anyone can imagine, is she's a Muslim. In addition to Halima, there are a number of other U.S. citizens from around the country who are also plaintiffs in this lawsuit because they can't get home. I want to tell you about one very sad case, a man named Eman Latif, who is a veteran of the Gulf War. He is disabled, and therefore the Veterans Administration was giving him disability benefits. Well, at one point, he and his wife went to live in Cairo. And while they were there, they had a baby. His family lived in Florida. So they decided they wanted to bring the baby home to meet the family. Plus, Eman, as a disabled veteran, was required to go to the Veterans Administration periodically so that they could check, you know, his disability to see whether the level of benefits was appropriate. So he goes with his wife and baby to the airport in Cairo, and he's told that he's not allowed to get on a plane. Why? Who knows? He's a Muslim. Surprise, but, you know, nobody can figure out why, in fact, this is a problem. The FBI comes and they interrogate him for hours and hours, which seems to be part of what happens to people on the no-fly list. Sometimes it seems to be connected with the FBI's desire to talk to somebody who otherwise might not have talked to them. So the FBI agents recommend that Eman be permitted to get back to the United States on a special exception. And somebody in Washington declines. So Eman is not, in fact, permitted to go back to the United States. So first the VA decides to lower his level of disability benefits because they don't really know what his level of disability is. And then they end up cutting him off altogether because he's not allowed to fly back to the country. Another one of our plaintiffs, Steve Washburn, is stuck in Ireland. The FBI agents, who also think he's just fine, they don't think it's a problem, they suggest to him that because he can't fly back to the country, he's an American citizen, he can't be banished, they suggest that he fly to Mexico and walk into the country at Ciudad Juarez because that would be allowed. I have one chapter in my book that's devoted to, I call it Traveling with Terror, and it's all about the no-fly lists, and it's all about also some of these security systems that we have. I think that the anti-terrorism measures at the airport are probably most familiar to most Americans. Yeah, how many of you have ever had any sort of experience at the airport? Okay, or seen somebody? Okay, a lot of hands are going up for people who are not in the room. So you people are kind of familiar with that, which is why in some ways it's amazing to me that after all this time we still don't have a really good and promising system for how to get people off the no-fly lists. How do people end up on the no-fly lists now? There's another ACLU client who I also want to tell you about, whose name is Eric Scherfen. He was a client of the ACLU of Pennsylvania. And Eric was also a veteran of the Gulf War, and while he was serving in the Gulf, one of the things that the government did, which I think was really a very good idea, was they did sensitivity training, and they taught the soldiers there about Islam, just so that they would understand the people who they were dealing with. So when Eric came back to this country, he found he was very interested in Islam as a religion. And so he decided to convert. He met a woman. They ended up opening an Islamic bookstore. And what he was doing for work, because he knew how to be a pilot, was he was working for a commercial airline. Well, one day, his employer tells him that he'd better figure out how to get himself off the no-fly list or they're going to have to fire him because they really can't have a pilot who's on the no-fly list. So Eric goes to the ACLU of Pennsylvania, and they end up bringing a lawsuit on his behalf. And as part of the lawsuit, one of the documents that they get hold of tells something about a tip that the FBI was given about Eric. Now, this may or may not be the whole explanation for why he's on the no-fly list. There may have been other things. Who knows? But what this said was that one of Eric's coworkers, who was aware of the fact that he was a Muslim, reported to the FBI that Eric was retrofitting his car to carry bombs. What was this based on? Eric had a broken seat in his car, and he took it out. Okay, so that's, you can get on the no-fly list. Ask Jan. You can get on the no-fly list without having anything to do with terrorism. So good process for getting off. Well, what happened to Eric when he was desperate to get off the no-fly list so he could keep his job was he got himself a redress control. Now, he complained and so forth. So what you get at the end of the process, I don't know if anybody here has ever had the experience of having to apply for one of these redress control numbers, but you complain to the Department of Homeland Security. In the course of time, they send you a response. And here, no kidding, I'm going to read this, is the response that Eric received after a four-month wait. Quote, in response to your inquiry concerning travel delays at the airline ticket counter or airport security checkpoint, we conducted a review of any applicable records in consultation with other federal agencies, as appropriate. Where it was determined that a correction to records was warranted, these records were modified to address any delay or denial of boarding that you may have experienced as a result of the Transportation Security Administration's watch list screening process. Complete explanation? Doesn't tell you a thing. Doesn't tell you whether you were on the watch list, doesn't tell you whether you've been taken off the watch list, doesn't tell you anything. So, one reason why I thought it would be interesting to start with this story tonight is that it's exemplary of all the other stories that I tell in the book about a whole pattern of what's been happening since the fall of 2001. And that pattern is, first of all this secrecy. We're not supposed to know what the government is doing. Everything happens behind the closed curtain. We're also supposed to expect that we're going to give up some of our liberties, the liberty to travel back to the United States or go from Oakland to, you know, to Long Beach or go to Chicago, perhaps, in order to be secure. And the whole idea of the Patriot Act and all these security measures that we put into place is kind of a common theme. They're all dragnets. This is like a security dragnet. We're going to put all these people's names on the list because they're all people who we think maybe, you know, some of them might be suspicious and who knows how they get there, you know, not a very reliable process. But it's, I think, telling to me that the agencies have not been that worried about how to get names off of the list as compared to putting names on the list, because that's the nature of a dragnet, right? And we bought into all these dragnets in the fall of 2001. The idea is let's do more security screening, keep more people off planes, do more surveillance, have more potential for prosecution, because what if? What if by doing that, by spreading that dragnet, we're going to catch somebody who might be a terrorist who we otherwise might not have caught? Okay, that's the reasoning. But if you think about it, it is necessarily true that when you have all these dragnets, you are also going to be getting innocent people. Now, I don't know if you saw there was a story less than a week ago about another Freedom of Information Act complaint that was brought in court about what the FBI is doing with their watch lists and what happens when people first report, you know, that they, like, as happened with Eric Scherfen, that, you know, somebody might be a terrorist. And what the FBI said is at this point they have 420,000 names on the watch lists altogether. Not all those people are Americans, and that's not all the no-fly list. There aren't as many on the no-fly list. But the other very interesting thing that they said was that if your name ends up on a watch list because you've been suspected of doing something wrong, even if you're charged with a crime and then cleared, your name doesn't leave. So it's all one way. You know, the government gathers. They gather names on watch lists. They gather, you know, information to fill up the government data banks. And they don't let go of things. They don't really winnow what they've had. The other theme that I think you heard a lot of, you know, ever since 9/11 is that, well, all of this is necessary. We have to have the dragnets because they have to be big enough to catch all the terrorists who are out there. What if a net is not big enough and we don't know about somebody who's a terrorist? And therefore, what we just have to do is we have to trust the government to only use their tools in the right place. We give them really big powers, and then we'll just assume that they're going to be people of good faith and they're only going to go after the terrorists. And, of course, they have no interest in keeping Jan and Rebecca from flying to Chicago. They got to Chicago, so where's the problem? What's the problem? I mean, the problem, again, as you can see from this story, is lack of due process. There's no sort of real hearing here. There could be very unreliable information, and people are inconvenienced, sometimes mildly, sometimes severely, by not being able to fly in this particular example. The threat of having too much discretion. One thing that the framers of the Constitution knew very deeply is that it's not a good idea to put too much power in one pair of hands. So what they set up in the Constitution is they set up, as you all know, very elaborate checks and balances, where when the executive branch does something under the president, the courts have a role if it's something important. Congress has a role if it's something important. What happens here, however, because it's all happening behind the curtain, are the executive agencies are just making their own decisions, and there's not a lot of accountability, and there's not a lot of oversight. Now, the framers of the Constitution knew, and this is what due process is about. It's about what the Fourth Amendment, which protects us against unreasonable searches and seizures, is about. It's about what the First Amendment is about. When you give the government too much discretion, there is a potential for arbitrary and discriminatory action. And it's actually very likely that that's going to happen. Discriminatory action? Well, I just told you several stories about people who apparently ended up on the no-fly list only because of their religion. I just told you a story about somebody who might have ended up on the no-fly list because of her political opinions that she was expressing. Okay, this is what we buy into when we give the government all of this power. So, people sometimes ask me, they usually ask this when I'm talking about other chapters here where I talk about surveillance, you know, the government having all these data banks and collecting all this information about all of us. People say, well, why should I care if the government knows everything I'm doing if I'm not doing anything wrong? Well, you know, some of you are chuckling. You know, I think it's to some of us the answer is obvious. Well, one reason why we should care is that if the government has the power not just to put our names on no-fly lists, so maybe we're not going to be able to travel, but if they also have the power to be asking librarians what we're reading, to ask our internet service providers what information they have about our lives, stop and think about that for a minute. If the words cloud computing don't mean anything to you, that means you're over 15, for one thing. But do you know at this point your internet service provider has access to your entire life? All of your photographs, your contacts, your calendar, that's all being stored on a cloud. In Benjamin Franklin's day, what was private to Benjamin Franklin, what was important to him, he would write in his diary, he would write in the family Bible, it was in his home. And the framers of the Constitution said in the Fourth Amendment, it's really important that the government not be able to search Benjamin Franklin's home unless they have a search warrant, unless they've involved the courts, and unless we have some check on whether they're being arbitrary or discriminatory, or whether they're targeting Benjamin Franklin because he has ideas that they're suspicious of or don't like. Okay, so the whole idea is that everything that you do really ends up needing some sort of check. I think I just want to tell you two more stories about the security screening, since that's the topic that I'm on. Again, in terms of what happens if you give too much discretion to government actors, because that's been the theme here. People say, well, we just have to trust the government. We want the government to have the power to keep us safe, and therefore we need to give them enough power. One of the chief themes of my book is, well, you know, giving the government all that power has its costs, and sometimes they're significant costs. So here are two stories about security screening that are not about the no-fly list. They're just about individual discretion. College student named Nick George, who lives in Philadelphia, is going to Pomona College in Southern California. I'm sure some of you know it. He's become interested in Middle Eastern studies. So one of the things he's doing is he's studying Arabic so that he can keep up on, you know, all these current events that are interesting to him. So he's on his way back to school for his senior year. He's 22 years old. And he decides, since it's a long flight from Philadelphia back to Pomona, he's going to bring his Arabic-English flashcards on the plane so he can study them. Okay, you see it coming, right? He didn't. So the person who discovers the Arabic flashcard says to Nick, do you know who did 9/11? Nick, who was 14 at the time, says, Osama bin Laden? Person is asking him, says, well, do you know what language he spoke? Now do you see why these cards are suspicious? Just on the basis of having Arabic-English flashcards, Nick was detained for 5 hours. He was put in a cell at the airport in Philadelphia. He was interrogated. He was terrified. He did miss his flight. And you know, he's now so indignant that he became a client of the ACLU. You can look up on our website, aclu.org, great website, the case called George versus TSA. Okay, so there's current ACLU client. Another person, and this is now not the airport, because the whole security screening idea has spread way beyond the airport at this point, as I'm sure many of you know. In New York City, where I come from, the subways now have this program that the New York Police Department has set up, where they put a table at your random subway stops. So you'll walk into a subway stop and you'll see the NYPD there at a table. And if you come in with a backpack or a large bag, they might stop you and ask if they can look inside your bag. Now, according to the NYPD, this program is random. When they first said they were having random searches, a New York Times reporter called me up because I teach the Fourth Amendment and said, well, what about that? Are random searches constitutional? I said, of course not. You know, there's a Supreme Court case saying you can't just stop people at random and check their driver's licenses because that gives rise to a potential for arbitrary and discriminatory enforcement. So evidently the reporter asked somebody at the NYPD and they asked their lawyer and they said, oh no, we didn't mean random like that. We meant random like, well, we're going to have a system, which the Supreme Court says is okay. We won't tell you what the system is, but every 15th person will check or something like that. You know, we won't tell you, but you know, there will be a system. We didn't mean random like we're just going to let the police stop whoever they want. So is this a really good way to stop terrorists? Well, I don't know if you know about the New York City subway system, but there are often multiple entrances to the same stop, and there's another stop six blocks down. So if, let's say, you know, somebody were a terrorist and they were to decide that they wanted to put a bomb in their backpack and bring it into the subway, there are, I don't know how many million riders on the subway in New York City on any given day, and a lot of different subway stops. The odds of the police having a table set up in the very subway stop where this terrorist is going is not high, or not high. And furthermore, if you are a terrorist and you're walking down the subway stairs with the bomb in your backpack and you see that the NYPD does have the table at that particular stop, well, what can you do? You can turn around and walk to the next stop. Okay, so I don't personally think that this is an incredibly effective way to deter terrorists. What I've heard people say, you know, friends of mine, they say, well, you know, yeah, you're right, it doesn't really deter terrorists, but it makes me feel better, you know, to have the police there. You know, so I think we're being fed placebos. Is that costly? Well, there's a young man of Kashmiri descent, he's an American citizen, lives in Brooklyn, and when he was stopped by the NYPD in this program for the 21st time, he became very aggravated, and he went to the New York Civil Liberties Union. Somebody there had the really interesting idea to get a statistician to calculate the odds of his being stopped that often, if in fact these stops were random. any statisticians in the audience who can do that calculation? One in 165 million. Okay, so he brings this lawsuit with the NYCLU against the NYPD, and they end up settling the lawsuit. He says, well, you know, I'm not really interested in some small amount of money. What I would really like is if you change your procedures so that this won't happen to anyone else. They said, no, we're going to give you money. So there's that lawsuit. He still is calling the NYCLU because he keeps being stopped. He's desperate. It's, you know, okay, you know, so I'm brown. You know, so I'm not a terrorist. So, you know, there's what we're buying into with all these security systems. And I think one of the things that really was concerning me as I'm writing the book is I wanted people to know more, first of all, about the costs of some of these dragnets in all different areas. Second of all, I think we really have to start raising some questions about what's effective. You know, the subway search program, I don't know how much they spend on that, and maybe it does make people feel more secure. But I just read a figure that, you know, take this with a grain of salt, because I'm not sure where it came from, but I just read this figure, that we in this country are actually spending more on national security, on anti-terrorism measures, than all the rest of the countries in the world combined. So we are spending a phenomenal amount of money on security screening, on surveillance, on investigations, and as I went along, it seems to me that there are a number of places where experts really question whether we're doing the right things, not just what the costs are, but what the effectiveness is, what the benefits are. Now, some of this we can't know because some of it is all happening behind the screen. Is it possible that the NYPD screening program or the no-fly list has led to disruption of terrorist plots? Nobody's telling us that. That's behind the screen. We don't really know. But there is some reason to be concerned that not only are some of the things that we started doing in the fall of 2001, before we knew a lot about what had happened on 9/11, may not only be ineffective, some of them may actually be counterproductive. So I want to give you one more example before we go to the question and answer, and I'll see what you'd like to talk about a concern that I have, because this is an assumption that was made in the fall of 2001 that I think it was either wildly overblown or maybe not true at all. So one of the assumptions underlying the Patriot Act, and also President Bush declared an emergency, which allowed him to designate a whole lot of individuals and organizations as specially designated terrorists, which meant that nobody is allowed to perform economic transactions with them at all. So if somebody's name, an individual or an organization's name, is on this list, you're not allowed to sell them a sandwich. You're not allowed to do anything involving an exchange of money with them. This statute was actually originally designed to give the president foreign policy power to declare a blockade on Libya or something like that, but it's actually been used to designate all these groups. So the president used this emergency power in the fall of 2001 to go after most of the major Muslim charities in this country. And this is a story that not many people know, but if you're interested in this, I have chapter 3. Plus, there was a great report by the ACLU called Blocking Faith, Freezing Charity. The government really disrupted and put out of business some of the major Muslim charities in this country. the theory here was that the best way to disrupt terrorism was to make sure that we cut off the pipeline of money to terrorists, and if they don't have money, they're not going to be able to be terrorists. So there was talk at the time about whether there was a pipeline going from mosques in Brooklyn, where Muslims were making donations, to Al-Qaeda. So the whole idea of this whole plan was, let's disrupt terrorism financing. Well, 5 years ago, the 9/11 Commission, I'm sure you all know they wrote this report, the 9/11 Commission staff wrote a special report on the problem of terrorism financing. And it's very educational. What they say is, you know, we actually think that the whole problem has been misdiagnosed. Yeah, and we know now, actually we know some of this even better from the WikiLeaks. We know that money is not going from the United States to Al-Qaeda. That, you know, the money that terrorists use, they use abroad. Plus, money is not a central part of what they're doing. So another whole theme of the Patriot Act, I don't know if any of you are in businesses where you have to have bought the Patriot Act compliance software, but there were all sorts of obligations imposed on all sorts of businesses, particularly financial institutions, to check watch lists and to institute very expensive money laundering programs, anti-money laundering programs. And companies have spent a fabulous amount of money checking to see whether they're doing business with any terrorists. The whole idea there, again, is that, you know, this is like a money laundering problem, and therefore, if we can just see the patterns of how terrorism financing is working, we can staunch the flow of money. Well, again, the 9/11 Commission staff says, no, you know, this just isn't like money laundering. There's a pattern there for money laundering. There's not really a pattern for terrorism that we can discern. So, the last story that I'll tell you here, there's this one other organization. Oh, actually, let me tell you about the Muslim charities first. So all these charities are designated as special designated terrorist organizations. In some cases, then, our government goes to other governments in the UK and Canada and other places to say, this is a really bad organization. This is an organization that's giving money to Al-Qaeda and funding terrorist actions. And therefore, we want you to take action against them also. Well, at that point, various people in other countries did look at the evidence that the United States had. So we don't really know anything about the basis on which most of these charities were designated, because that's behind the curtain. But we do know what people concluded then in the UK and in Canada, because a lot of them had more public processes. And in a number of instances, they looked at our designations and said, you have to be kidding. There was one case where somebody in the Canadian Ministry of Justice looked at the evidence that he got from the Americans. He said, well, we looked at the evidence, and there was no evidence. So there's this entire chapter, which I think is quite shameful. In my book, I talk about the Muslims who were, you know, really feeling terrorized by the FBI. FBI agents are infiltrating their mosques, knocking on their doors to ask about why they made contributions to charities, not even only the charities on the blacklists. So, final chapter. There's a charity called Kind Hearts, which Kind Hearts for Charitable Humanitarian Development, based in Toledo, Ohio. And when some of the major Muslim charities were put out of business, the founders of Kind Hearts were very upset, because they concluded that without those charities, there were some very needy people in parts of the world who were not going to have a source of humanitarian aid. They were concerned about refugees in Lebanon and various people. So they decided that they were going to start a charity and do everything right. They were going to follow every piece of advice from the Treasury Department to the letter. They were going to make sure that they were above board. And so they set out to, you know, give toys to children in Lebanon and food and so forth. And they're going about their business when one day they're not put on the blacklist, but some investigator has a question about what they're doing. So they're told, we're freezing your assets. Okay, now what does that do if you're a charity? If you're a charity, it puts you out of business. So they're not allowed to do anything at this point. So there they are. They have no assets. They're not allowed to use their assets. Do they know what they've done wrong? No. Nobody in the Treasury Department has told them anything about what they've done wrong. They've never gotten any cease and desist command. At one point, there was one person who was working for them who people were saying that he worked with Hamas. So they fired him. They were so determined not to raise any suspicions, but didn't work. So the government held on to their assets. This provision in the Patriot Act, again, familiar theme, there's no due process. There's not even a timeline. The government held on to their assets for 2.5 years. They just held the assets. Okay, no deadline, no hearing, no rights. You know, that's just it. This is an American organization. So at that point, they decide that they're going to bring a lawsuit, and they're going to sue the government to say, what's going on here? Could we please have our money back? You know, we think that's an unreasonable seizure of our assets. Where's the due process? What did we do wrong? Could you please tell us? So the first thing that they run up against is that their lawyer is not allowed to represent them. Why not? That's a financial transaction, and they're now radioactive too. Okay, so their lawyer applies for a license, which is what you have to do. You have to apply to the Office of Foreign Assets Control in the Treasury, even though this is an American company, American corporation. They have to apply for a license to represent the charity. The lawyer applies for a license, and the license is granted, but he's then told, well, you know, he'd have to work for free. So the organization found someone to work for free, the ACLU, what do you know, and a few other organizations that were willing to do that. But, you know, I think that's really pretty shocking, the idea that, you know, we've gotten to this point, and I think there are a lot of things here that people don't know. I think what I'm going to do is I'm just going to stop there because I want to allow plenty of time. I'm actually not going to stop. I'm going to do one thing before I stop, which is I thought I was going to stop. Sorry, Jim. People often ask me, why did you write this book? And this is a question some of you had. So I begin, it's not a good thing to tell the end of the book, but I'm going to tell you the beginning. I begin by telling the anecdote about a woman who said to me, so yeah, tell me what the ACLU is doing these days, but don't tell me about that Guantanamo stuff. She said, I'm so sick of hearing about that. Why should I care about those people when they're not even Americans? So I set out actually to write this book to answer her question. And in this book, I don't talk about that Guantanamo stuff or torture or targeted drones, which I'm happy to talk about if that's what you want to talk about. But what I say to this woman is I say, you're wrong. And let me just read you a list of some of the things that I have in the introduction, which may give you a sense of some of the things I haven't just told you about so you can see where you might have questions. She could be one of the hundreds of thousands of innocent Americans the FBI has been spying on using the broad net of the Patriot Act and supplemental powers. Her banker and her stockbroker, among many others, have collected financial and other personal data about her to lodge in government data banks, ready to trigger an investigation of her if the government happens to connect some dot of information to her dots, even if she's done nothing wrong. Her computer geek neighbor might be one of the innumerable telecommunications workers and librarians whom the FBI has conscripted to gather information on hundreds of thousands of occasions, hundreds of thousands, perhaps about her friends or acquaintances, and then ordered not to tell anyone anything about their experience on pain of criminal prosecution. Her nephew could be the computer studies student prosecuted for providing, quote, material support to terrorists because he served as a webmaster for a website posting links to other people's hateful comments. Her son could be the college student detained and interrogated for packing his Arabic English flashcards to study during a plane flight. She could find herself unable to complete an important business or personal trip because her name was incorrectly placed on a no-fly list or simply because she has a common name like, quote, T. Kennedy. Her favorite charity could be shut down for years or even permanently because a government bureaucrat once decided to investigate it, even if the investigation went nowhere. Her generous contribution toward humanitarian relief might be sitting in government escrow for years instead of reaching the intended recipients or being returned to her. Her doctor's assistant could be the young Kashmiri American who was stopped and searched in the New York City subways on 21 separate occasions, even though the odds of the same person being selected for a, quote, random search that often are 1 in 165 million. Now, there's a bit of a panorama. So let me turn to Jeff and see what questions he or any of you have.
Great. Well,
thank you.
First of all, I want to offer two thank yous. The first is to Chuck and Nan Geschke for sponsoring this critically important series, which has been going on for some time now. We may disagree around issues politically, all of us in this room, but one thing I think we can agree on is that we need a dialogue in this country so that we can discuss issues in a way to protect the liberties that we all treasure. And Chuck and Nan, who I've known for a long time, you're helping to do just that. Thank you very much. And also I want to thank Professor Herman Susan for writing this book. It's a wonderful contribution and one that hopefully will be widespread. We have many questions that have come up, and I'd like to pan way back to start. And here's a question that cuts right to the chase. And I'll just add a comment from another question. The question is simply, do we need the Patriot Act? Why or why not? And then somebody else writes, which I will add as a paren and paren, do you have any idea how many terrorist incidents may have been averted due to aggressive administration of terrorist tactics and strategies? How many lives might have been saved? Maybe that's a good place
okay,
to start.
Okay, I think it's a great combination of questions, too. I'm glad you paired those. So the Patriot Act, this is something else that a lot of people don't know. The Patriot Act, my copy, when I first printed out of 300 pages. It's a grab bag of hundreds of amendments to previous law in all sorts of different areas. So some of the provisions are great. There's one provision in there that's a sense of Congress resolution that says, let's not use this as an excuse to discriminate against Muslims. Some of them are useful updatings of the law, and some of them are not good. So I suspect that when somebody asks the question, do you need the Patriot Act, most of what people are talking about are the surveillance provisions, the provisions that make it much easier for the government to find out all about what we're doing. Again, I'm narrowing the answer because there's so many different provisions in the Patriot Act that we would have to talk separately about to really do the question justice. But the surveillance provisions all have a theme. And the theme is let's let the government have more power without having as much review from the courts and without having as much oversight from Congress. Now, not only do we not need that, but I think it's just a really bad idea. The court that's involved in most of these searches, the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Court, which is a secret court, even though, you know, foreign is kind of misleading. I talk about that in the book, too, how the foreign intelligence model has come to apply to Americans. But that court has granted the government's applications for, you know, warrants to listen to people's conversations, et cetera, in like 99-point-something% of the time. I have the figures in my book. So the whole idea that it would be a problem for the government to have to ask the court's permission before they're looking at your library records or your educational records or your medical records or your internet service provider records, it's just not true that the government would be held back. You know, the court is going to be really easy on them. What's the point of having judicial review then? Well, it may be something of a deterrent against the government using its powers in a discriminatory fashion, just need to feel that somebody's watching. So I think that those parts of the Patriot Act were not a good idea. Do they keep us safe? Okay, here again, we have a major problem with the curtain that's up. Let me tell you about one provision, because here's one where there was an attempt to answer that question. Mostly, you know, we don't really know. The government doesn't really tell us, and so it's hard to evaluate. But there's this one provision that was ramped up by the Patriot Act called National Security Letters. And in this area, the FBI, and some other agencies too, can go to internet service providers, telecommunications providers, librarians, because libraries have computers, and they can ask for some kinds of information without going to a court at all. It's just, you know, a self-issued order, and part of it, as my little summary in the introduction suggested, what's then attached is they tell you you're never allowed to tell anybody that you got this order asking for somebody else's information. Well, the whole idea of the Patriot Act was, well, you know, let's not have the courts get in the way because we just want to give the executive branch the power to do this and we don't want to take a chance. They should just have the power to get whatever information they want to look at. And, you know, Congress doesn't really need to supervise. Well, after some very interesting litigation, which I talk about in the book, on behalf of an internet service provider and some librarians, Congress finally became interested in the fact that there was all this power being exercised. So they asked the Inspector General of the Justice Department to look at how the FBI was using its power under this provision. The idea under the Patriot Act was, well, we'll just let the agency police itself. We'll have senior officials in the agency, and they'll set up regulations and procedures, and it'll be all right because, after all, they're not going to be interested in what any of you are reading in the library. They're only interested in terrorists. So what the Inspector General found, this is a 2007 report, what he found was that when the agency was just given this power to exercise in secret when they thought nobody else was watching, they did formulate some regulations, and then they violated them 2,000 or 3,000 times. Okay, well, they thought nobody was watching. You know, who knows what they were doing? They, in fact, got so careless, they got so accustomed to the fact that the telecommunications providers were turning over information that they stopped even using the formal national security letters and started using yellow post-its or sending an email. So, you know, this to me is like a case study. You know, can we trust the government with enormous dragnets of power that they're using without somebody watching? No. Okay, so the Inspector General then tried to address the second part of your question. Well, what are we getting from this? Have national security letters, in fact, helped us to foil any terrorist plots? Answer number one, well, the FBI isn't keeping track of information like that. We can't tell. Answer number two, they found almost nothing. And in most of the Inspector General reports, when the Inspector General has tried to say, well, what have we gotten from the National Security Agency surveillance? Have we foiled any plots? Generally, the answer is, well, we don't see much evidence of it. But then there's one part in the report where they say, well, then it's possible that this information did contribute to some of what the government did in black, 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 black. So, you know, that's part of the problem, is, you know, the secrecy, and we can't really talk about that. I think that, again, you, because the Patriot Act involves so many different kinds of powers, and because there's so many different things involved, you can't answer that question really all in one fell swoop. As to some of the powers, like the terrible time that the charities have been given, there's very little reason to think that we've really gotten anything out of that. Not much reason to think we've gotten a lot of benefit from the national security letters. So what I'm saying, I would not say get rid of the Patriot Act. What I'm saying, my bottom line is, I think after 10 years, it's about time that we had real hearings to try to ask these questions. Congress never asked these questions when they first adopted the Patriot Act 6 weeks after 9/11, with no hearings, no testimony, no real discussion. And I just think it's about time we have this discussion, and I think that the American people can be trusted with a little more information than the government has been willing to give us so far.
Thank you for that comprehensive answer.
Well, I know it's long. He means long.
I want to remind our listening audience that you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program, and our speaker today is Susan Herman, president of the ACLU, who is discussing the erosion of civil liberties and American democracy since 1911, and is author of her new book, Taking Liberties, The War on Terror and the Erosion of American Democracy. If we had to list the most popular topic, it would be the recent killing of al-Awlaki last Friday. Several questions in that regard. And in some, the questions ask, in your view, should we have the right to kill individuals like Awlaki, even though he is a U.S. citizen, living as he was in Yemen and making threats against U.S. citizens, and with some evidence he had tried to carry out some of those threats? And as a parallel question and a point of comparison, would you distinguish the murder of bin Laden and Awlaki? And a question that I've been thinking about is, had Awlaki been, say, in Trenton, New Jersey, would we have had the right to take him out there? So the question is basically, what is the legality and limits of killing of U.S. citizens such as Awlaki?
Well, it's hard to avoid giving complex answers when you have such complex questions, right? Yeah. So that covers a lot of territory. So let me say a few things about that. First, in terms of the distinction between Osama bin Laden and Mr. Awlaki, I think the fact that Mr. Awlaki is an American citizen is an enormous difference. Osama bin Laden does not have constitutional rights. Mr. Awlaki does. A lot of people say, oh, but, you know, he was a bad guy, and therefore he doesn't deserve due process. Yet where have we heard that argument before? Through the history of the American criminal justice system, it's been when communities get all upset about, you know, they're sure that they know who's done something wrong, and therefore they don't need to give them a fair trial because they're absolutely sure they know who deserves to be lynched. Yeah, that's the road to horrible injustice. Now, what people say is, oh, but, you know, this is just one guy, and isn't it okay that, you know, that he was killed because he was such a bad guy? Yet, to me, that's how it starts. Once you say the government has the power to designate an American citizen an enemy and to say, you deserve to be killed and we're just going to kill you wherever we are, wherever you happen to be. At that point, you know, first of all, you're buying into a situation where sooner or later there's going to be somebody the government designates who is not guilty. Second, the government has been very reluctant to tell us what standards it's using. My answer to, is it possible that it was permissible for us to kill Mr. Awlaki? I think that's possible. But I think we need to know what kinds of standards and criteria the government is applying. One question that is not encompassed in your set of questions there, Jeff, but that some people ask is, well, does Mr. Awlaki have First Amendment rights as a citizen to say, you know, let's kill everybody? The First Amendment, as I'm sure many people know, has its limits. You all know, you know, about you're not allowed to yell fire in a crowded theater. You're also not allowed to say, hey, let's go kill Americans. If you're actually inciting people to action, as, you know, arguably Mr. Awlaki was, certainly you're guilty of a crime. Now, the Supreme Court has a lot of very careful law talking about the circumstances under which it's permissible for the police to shoot somebody, to kill somebody who's trying to escape being brought to justice. That model might apply to Mr. Awlaki, but I think what's really troubling here is that we don't know what standards the government is using, what process they're using, where do they get the information, who else might be next, what are they doing to try to cut down the number of civilian casualties. And the question that Jeff asked, well, you know, if this is their position, that we have a worldwide war on terror, and it can apply beyond a theater of war that we're in, like Afghanistan, to Yemen and to Pakistan. Why not San Francisco? So I think it's very troubling, and I think, again, I think what we mostly need is we need a lot of answers and we need a lot of discussion. I'm so glad that everybody's talking about this. The news media were all saying, oh my goodness, you look at this, how controversial what the president has done. Well, as president of the ACLU, let me tell you how proud I am that the ACLU was not only there after the fact. We tried filing a lawsuit on behalf of Mr. Alalaki's father. He was a client of the ACLU, and he wanted to challenge the fact that his son was on this list of people to be killed summarily, and, you know, who knew why. And this is another theme in my book, the court said, oh, we don't want to hear from you. You know, if your son came in, maybe, we're not, you're just his father, what, you know, no. Okay, and so the courts have been really unusually deferential in this whole area and letting the executive branch do what they want, which to me is a recipe for abuse of power. So regardless, this is something that, you know, I think the ACLU is often hard-pressed to explain to people out on the street why process matters. But regardless what you think of this individual example, the process does matter.
Okay, there... A question asked, do you think the Bush administration used the war on terror to advance a conservative ideology, i.e. the strengthening of the executive branch? And before you answer that, I would just add that one of the themes in your book, which I recommend to everybody, is that all administrations, as I read it, Clinton, Bush, and now the Obama administration, a large degree have really employed much the same policies. So my question to you is, in answer to this question, is there a difference between the administrations? And if so, what is it? And what would you like to see more from the Obama administration now?
Two other excellent questions. As you say, as the question suggests, there are those who have criticized the Bush administration and said, oh, well, this was all just opportunism in order to strengthen the executive branch. Andrew Bacevich wrote a book, you know, to that effect. I don't go there. You know, I don't try to psychoanalyze the Bush administration, and I'm not looking to be ad hominem. As Jeff says, I think it's quite remarkable that, you know, Clinton and then Bush and then Obama have taken pretty much the same position about the domestic side of the war on terror. Now, I'm saying domestic to distinguish it from that Guantanamo stuff, which I don't write about in my book. There, I think President Obama did try to take a different position. In executive orders he issued in his first day, he said, I'd like to close Guantanamo. I don't like the idea that the president can designate enemy combatants and just say, you know, no due process, no hearings, and therefore we are going to have innocent people at Guantanamo, as we clearly did. He said, I don't want to use torture. I want to go back to the U.S. Army field manual. I don't want these enhanced interrogation techniques. That apparently has stuck, although we seem to still be doing extraordinary renditions and sending people to other countries where they can be tortured. So he did make an attempt to really take a different position as to those issues. However, on the kinds of issues that I talk about here, the issues that really affect us as ordinary Americans, in the surveillance area, for example, and the Patriot Act issues, President Obama has been defending his ability to use all of the same powers that the Bush administration has. As a candidate, President Obama said, no more national security letters that allow, you know, the government to spy on Americans without what the Fourth Amendment should require. As president, however, he's holding on to that power. Now, as Jeff says, I think that that's not anything that's really personal to Barack Obama. I think it's just something in the nature of the position that we put our presidents into. The 9/11 Commission, which I think, you know, if you haven't looked at their report, I think they did such an intelligent report. But one thing they say is that no American president can guarantee the American people's safety. So if the president makes us think that they can do that, you know, that's just very misleading, and it's really treating us as children to say, yeah, I promise you, you can be safe if you only just give me all these powers. If just, this is an insecure world, and we all just have to, in some ways, learn to deal with that fact. But Obama says, you know, one quotation I have from him is, you know, first thing I think about every morning is keeping the American people safe. And I think that the expectation that the American public has that the president can keep us safe if we just give him enough power is what leads to the political inertia that really makes it impossible for any president to give up the dragnets. Right? They're going to look like they're not being tough on terror. And unfortunately, and this is something the ACLU, we spend all of our time trying to combat this, unfortunately, it's not that politically popular to give up people's rights. you know, politicians don't get a whole lot of criticism for doing that. So there's another very interesting book written by Jack Goldsmith, who was in the Department of Justice in the Bush administration, called The Terror Presidency. And what he says is, you know, look back beyond Clinton, Franklin Roosevelt, you know, the beloved liberal president. What did he do during World War II? He allowed the incarceration of loyal Japanese Americans. Abraham Lincoln allowed the suspension of habeas corpus during the Civil War. There's something that goes on, a dynamic, that really makes it impossible for presidents to limit their own powers. So the whole idea, I think one reason why some people ended up voting George Bush out of office was that they didn't trust him with all the dragnets. They didn't trust him not to target political opponents. They didn't trust him not to go after Muslims. So some people have said to me, you know, that's why I voted for Barack Obama, because I thought he was going to do everything right. Someone said to me just today, he said, you know, all my friends say once Bush was out of the White House, they said, okay, we don't have to worry anymore. And so I think that that's where Barack Obama comes from. Do you believe that you could be trusted with a dragnet and you would use good judgment? President Obama has to think that. That's just human nature. Well, you know, I was afraid when someone else had the dragnet that they might go after the wrong people, but I'm not going to go after the wrong people. Oh, the material support laws let me prosecute the Red Cross. Let me prosecute lawyers for writing briefs on behalf of clients. Let me prosecute the Humanitarian Law Project for trying to talk terrorists out of being terrorists. Well, you know, I'm not going to do that. That's okay. I'm only going to use the powers against terrorists. And that's where I think, you know, I'm disappointed in President Obama, because as a former constitutional law professor, he should get that this is not only about him and whether he has good judgment. This is going to be all other presidents. Plus, I think some of these dragnets do harm by their mere existence. And perhaps to the extent that people do trust Obama not to come after them for reading the biography of Osama bin Laden, perhaps there's less of a chilling effect for the time being while he's president. But there are going to be other presidents, and the statute of limitations will not yet have run on some of these crimes. So I think it's a shame that while we have a constitutional law professor, we've not been able to roll back some of these limitations on our freedoms.
Speaking of the relationship of the branches and overreaching by the executive branch, you note in your book the interesting fact that the courts have been largely silent in terms of fashioning law relating to the Patriot Act and other security matters that we're discussing here. How do you account for that? And do you see any hope for the courts stepping in a way to achieve a better balance than we seem to have at the moment?
Well, there again, I draw a distinction between the subjects that I don't discuss in this book, that Guantanamo stuff, and the things that I do talk about, surveillance and so forth. I think the Supreme Court played a remarkable role in a series of four cases of, you know, talking back to the Bush administration to say, you can't just declare people to be enemy combatants without any due process and put them in a land without law in Guantanamo. And the court really did stand up to that, and that was really historic. But the Supreme Court has accepted three cases about the domestic war on terror. All three of those cases were cases in which the government had lost below. The government was trying to argue that it should have more power, or that the previous government officials who had done various things that were being challenged should be immune from lawsuits. In all three of the cases, the Supreme Court took those cases and reversed the cases to favor the government's position. There are, I give a long list of cases in the book, over a dozen cases, where courts below had ruled against constitutional claims that individuals were raising. In other words, the government had won. And the court just said, oh, we don't want to hear that. We don't want to hear that. So, you know, the Supreme Court clearly, pretty clearly has a side on these issues. And they're much less concerned with the rights involved than they are with the government having enough power. This Humanitarian Law Project, let me give you one example here. As I was mentioning, the organization in California, I don't know if any of you know about it, I think Southern California was really more the home of it, which peace activists who really were determined to try to work with would-be terrorists to teach them to use nonviolent means of dispute resolution. So they were working particularly with the Kurds in Turkey, who I'm sure some of you are aware have grievances against the Turkish government. And they were trying to show them ways that they could work through the UN and use peaceful dispute resolution methods instead of turning to terrorism in order to make their points. Well, when the Patriot Act came into being and expanded the material support laws to allow prosecution for what they call expert advice or assistance to terrorists, giving expert advice or assistance, the people at the Humanitarian Law Project began to worry, because that's not just guns and money. That, you know, could have described what they were doing. So they end up litigating this case for like a decade through the California courts, end up in the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court said two things to them. They said, yeah, you're right. You're covered by this. You could be prosecuted. Careful. And then when the Humanitarian Law Project said, well, what about the First Amendment? You know, we're expressing political points of view. We're talking to people. The Supreme Court says literally, well, yes, this is about speech, but whether you're allowed to speak here depends on what you want to say. And the government says they don't think it's a good idea for you to talk to terrorists, and therefore, you know, no, there's an exception to the First Amendment. They can do this. That's fine. Okay, so that's the Supreme Court. The lower courts have been dismissing cases as fast as they come in, almost. There are a few exceptions here, but most of the lower courts have dismissed virtually every case they come across on procedural grounds. Oh, no, you can't talk about this. It's the state secrets privilege. Oh, no, that person's immune. Oh, no, you don't have standing. You're the wrong person. So the surveillance provisions have mostly turned out to be impossible to challenge, because what the courts say is if you come in and you say, listen, I'm being harmed by this surveillance provision. I am, for example, a lawyer. I have a client who is in Guantanamo who's from Yemen. I need to talk to people in Yemen about possibilities of being witnesses and so forth. They won't talk to me on the telephone or email me because they're afraid that the National Security Agency is listening to the conversations and they're going to end up on the no-fly list. So I have to fly to Yemen every time I want to talk to someone. This is really, really expensive. Scholars, journalists, everybody else is saying, I'm being harmed by this. Yeah, everybody, you know, this whole climate is really hurting me. The courts all say, oh, no, you don't have standing to challenge this. You're not being injured. The only injury that counts, if you want to tell a court that a surveillance power is unconstitutional, the only way you can have standing to raise that claim is if you know that you have actually been under secret surveillance. You notice a catch-22 there? Yeah, the whole point of secret surveillance is they don't tell you. So occasionally there have been extremely bizarre cases where people actually do know that they were under surveillance, but mostly the courts are just there fouling away every case as fast as they can. They don't want to hear them. And I think a lot of it is judges are people too. You know, we have this whole idea that, you know, you can't prevent the government from having the power that might prevent terrorism. And I think, you know, the courts are also, judges are human. And what's happened here, which I think gets a little depressing, is that every branch of the federal government is all sort of lined up on the same side in lockstep. So what does that leave? Leaves us. Right.
Thank you. It's interesting to read the questions because this can become an abstract discussion about civil liberties. And I think one of the beauties of your book is the way you bring personal stories to the fore.
Oh, thank you.
But what's interesting in the questions is that this is not an abstract topic to many in our audience. So there's a series of comments here, and I'll just give you phrases. As a person on a blacklist, is there a hotline for assistance? I had a full body scan. How do I protect my right to personal integrity? I felt there was nothing that I could do. How safe do you feel when you're booked on an aircraft to New York at Kennedy? Is the TSA really doing a good job? And then more plaintiff cries of, how do we get our power back now that the government seems to have control of the data and the playing field? So to me, this is what I characterize as ask for help questions.
I think the other common theme in the questions and comments that you're describing here is a sense of powerlessness. A lot of people talk about the surveillance idea, the whole idea that post-Patriot Act, the way that trends have gone is that the government has more and more power to find out everything that we're doing, and we have less and less power to find out what the government is doing, which is sort of, you know, turning democracy upside down. But a lot of people use the sort of the literary illusion that this is Orwellian. And one person who I quote says, no, Orwell is not the metaphor here. This isn't just Big Brother. This is Kafka. This is that people have a sense of powerlessness. And this is a sense of, you know, the government having power over people. And that's why the subtitle of my book, people think of the ACLU as being about rights. Okay, we've lost some privacy, we've lost some due process, you have to take off your shoes at the airport. That's all about individual loss of liberty. To me, what's going on here is much bigger. I think we have been changing the nature of American democracy. That's where the erosion of American democracy comes in, by shifting all the power into one branch and by allowing ourselves to be disempowered. If we're not getting enough information from the government, that's because we're putting up with that. The government started out with this mosaic theory, saying we can't tell you anything about what we're doing at all, because under their mosaic theory, any tiny bit of information might be helpful to the enemy. So, you know, we had one lawsuit that the ACLU brought actually against national security letters where the government said, you're not allowed to post on your website the fact that you have this litigation pending because that could help the enemy. And the judge said, huh? And the judge said, no, I think it's actually perfectly safe to post on the ACLU website the fact that you have a lawsuit challenging the constitutionality of national security letters. So this whole, you know, I think that the political forces here are very, very strong. But I think that we have been letting the government get away with this. And we have to start talking back. We have to say, no, we need to know. The president is not the decider. We're the deciders.
Well, and that last portion of the answer to your question was a direct response to this question, which you've now answered. How much is the American populace to blame for its failing to stand up to the government's fear-mongering? Not an easy task, but I think you've answered that. And we have time, maybe we have 60 seconds.
so you have to read quickly.
Yeah, I would just ask this. Where are we really? Because you explain with depressing detail why the courts, the executive, and the legislative branches all have reacted as they have. And you also note with eloquence how the American people have been silenced because of a lack of information and fear. If this is all true, where are we? You ended a recent talk with a rally cry that it's good that we will all be on the ramparts. And the question
right.
is, do you really believe that?
Well, I do. Linda Greenhouse, in describing my book, said that I was offering the wake-up call we need to regain our perspective and reclaim our values. So I think that's true. This is about us. But in terms of where we are, I think I'd like to end in our remaining 30 seconds with a quote from Justice William Oates Douglas, that I think this is a good metaphor for where we are. As nightfall does not come all at once, neither does oppression. In both instances, there is a twilight when everything remains seemingly unchanged, and it is in such twilight that we all must be most aware of change in the air, however slight, lest we become unwitting victims of the darkness. So thank you all for being here.
I want to acknowledge all the other questions that were asked that were excellent questions that we did not have time to answer. But now, of course, I want to thank Susan Herman, Professor Herman, Brooklyn Law School, President of the ACLU. And we thank our audiences here and on radio, television, and also on the Internet. Tonight's program has been part of the Commonwealth Club series on the U.S. Constitution in the 21st century, underwritten by the Charles Geschke family. I'm Jeffrey Brand, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, celebrating more than a century of light and discussion, is adjourned. Thank you very much.